This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, February 6th, 2013. Topic for this week for current Jewish questions is Women of the Wall. You planned to do it a couple of weeks ago, but it was cold and people were away, so no harm in moving it to today. Does anyone here know about the Women of the Wall? Heard about them?
Yeah, well, I studied in Pardes this summer, and some of the women that were studying there were like in it.
Oh,
participating.
Oh, fantastic! So some of the stuff isn't going to be new to you.
They're like feminists, right? They're like the.
Well, by definition, you'd have to be. I shouldn't say by definition, because that gets into a whole fight about what exactly
sure
is feminism.
Right thing,
but yes, you would assume if you have a group called the Women of the Wall, there is some feminist nature behind it. But I don't want to get into a fight over feminism. But we will have an interesting discussion over what this is. And what we're going to do is we're going to discuss a little bit of the history. We're going to discuss some personal statements and reactions in terms of what are the issues. And then we're going to discuss some halachic ramifications of what's going on. Like we do, every week, but this also will be a nice combination of what's on the ground, what are some relevant halachot to it, and we'll see that it really is not that simple. There are a lot of competing factors at work here. I'll say right off the bat, I'm not sure if either side is 100% right, but let's take a look at why. I'll start off by skimming through the history here. This is from Sarah Simkowitz, writing from JewishVirtualLibrary.org, that says the Women of the Wall were founded in December of 1988 during the first International Jewish Feminist Conference in Jerusalem, where about 100 women who attended the conference went to pray at the Kotel, where they were disrupted by verbal and physical assaults by ultra-Orthodox men and women. After a particularly bad incident, they filed a petition to the government of Israel. The response, which was negative, included a list of extreme halachic opinions that ban women from praying in groups, touching a Torah scroll, and wearing religious garments. Fast forward, 1991, they appealed to the Supreme Court, and in 1994, they lost their case, but the Supreme Court decided that a commission should be set to resolve the issue. In 96, the commission proposed that they move to the southeastern corner of Jerusalem outside the Old City. They found this unacceptable and applied for a new commission. So first it went to the courts of, like, you're not allowed to do this. There was an attempt, like, well, don't do it at the Kotel, do it at some other part within the old, actually here it says here, outside the Old City. They said, nope, not good. So, moved on. Fast forward to 97. Shas tried to pass a bill that would change the status of the Kotel from a national site to an official Orthodox synagogue. Bill did not pass. May 22, 2002, the court ruled in favor of the Women of the Wall, granting them the right to wear prayer shawls at the Kotel, pray aloud, and read from a Torah scroll as part of the prayer service. Jewish feminists all over the world rejoice, but the happiness was shattered when the state appealed the decision. Finally, in 2005, a panel of 9 judges ultimately ruled against the Women of the Wall. And though they lost the case in the Supreme Court, they continue to worship at the wall, and you have, to this day, whenever they do so, make the press or make the news when there is some, altercations with the police, including last month. All right. So that's a very brief history.
So I know nothing about this. Is this like women and they want to read from the Torah at the Kotel? Is that pretty much what they're
You know what? Let's go counterclockwise this time. Because of you asked that question,
okay.
Take source number 2 here. This is from the official Women of the Wall mission statement that I retrieved from their website. You have the date there. I doubt anything has changed, but go ahead.
Okay. As Women of the Wall, our central mission is to achieve the social and legal recognition of our right as women to wear prayer shawls, pray, and read from the Torah collectively and out loud at the Western Wall. We work to further our mission through social advocacy, education, and empowerment. In our social advocacy work, we aim to change the status quo that is currently preventing women from being able to pray freely at the Western Wall. This goal has great ramifications for women's rights in Judaism and in Israel, and must be achieved through social advocacy in order to raise awareness and change the social perception of these issues. We take it upon ourselves to educate Jewish women and the public about the social, political, and personal ramifications of limiting and eliminating women's right to pray as a group at a holy site. When the law and when society literally, publicly, and deliberately silence women in prayer, it is a violation of civil rights, human rights, and religious freedoms. Education is the key to changing perspectives, laws, and lives. Every time we meet to pray, we empower and encourage Jewish women to embrace religion freely in their own way. We stand proudly and strongly in the forefront of the movement for religious pluralism in Israel in the hopes to inspire and empower women from all over the world and across the spectrum of Jewish movements to find their spiritual voice. With this great mission before us, our vision is to strengthen and expand our organization, to reach out and influence policymakers and leaders to demand full access to prayer at the Western Wall for women. In addition, Women of the Wall works to expand our network of allies and partners around the world who will advocate and take action with us.
All right, so what do you take away from this?
Well, pretty much answered my question.
Well, yes. You've got two things going on here, really. The first is the very specific, which is, and you know, I have it bolded here, wear prayer shawls, mean the tallit, pray read from the Torah, and you know I should fix their typo there. This was all copy-pastes here. Collectively and out loud at the Western Wall. So public demonstration of worship, being able to do so, you know, vocally, like normally, like they otherwise would do, wearing tallit in public. That is a very specific demand. Right? In a broader scheme, right, throwing in a whole bunch of other stuff here in terms of, you know, it says here, advocacy about women's rights in general, throws in civil rights, human rights, and religious freedoms, implication being that as a measure of religious freedom, people should be able to worship where they want, whenever they want, as they want. And a very general globalized, you know, so it's not just this, but there's a more overarching universalistic type ethic that they seem to be aspiring to here. Though it's hard to say, honestly, how much of this is for, you know, to make their limited struggle seem as part of a much broader struggle, in which case it's only for political sides, or at least PR, versus how much, no, they really believe, truly believe in complete and total do what you want, where you want, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. All right.
I have a question.
Sure.
I don't remember from the women I talked to, but I thought that they told me that they do like the Baruch Hu. They like have a, they like count themselves as a minion. Is that correct? Or is that, I mean, it doesn't say anything about it here, but it says pray and read from the Torah collectively and out loud.
You know, I honestly don't know because I've never davened with them.
Would it make a difference?
Okay. Well, what difference do you think that would make?
I think that would be more of a halachic issue if they were saying that they were.
So your argument counting. Would be, okay, so if
they were just doing a Torah service.
Yeah.
So like we do that here, like women are.
Yeah, but so you're actually hitting on a wonderful point, which is people have halachic arguments over stuff. So whose halacha do you follow? People would say what we do here is wrong. Now you would say, well, counting women in a minyan is wrong. There are Jews out there who says, of course women can count in a minyan.
Right? I think it's the line between like whether they're doing it in an Orthodox, like...
Ah, but if you're talking about religious freedom, why would that matter? But you are hitting on a really fantastic point.
Yeah, I feel
point.
Like it does matter, though, especially in Israel. Like, if they're saying they're conservative, meaning they all count themselves as a minyan, that's like a big issue for...
Well, it'd be a big issue for sure. So
for anyone in
the truth is, you are really getting at some core issues about the dynamics that we're going to flesh out wonderfully in the next, you know, is this like by coincidence that like you guys are reading ahead before your turn? So going through in a little bit more detail, and I included this because you have some incredibly revealing quotes that do speak to many of the issues that you're raising. And this is from the New York Times coverage in December. All right. So just take the underlined statements here. To prevent the women.
To prevent the women from defying a Supreme Court ruling that bars them from wearing ritual garments at the wall, they were blocked by police officers from bringing them in. How can you say this to me? I'm a Jew. This is my state.
Right. This was one particular woman, a Canadian immigrant who helped find it, saying, how can you say this to me? I'm a Jew. This is my state. What do you think is behind that statement? I am a Jew. This is my state.
That any Jew has the right to wear a talis.
Well, not just wear a talis. It's every Jew has a right to basically pray or do, you know, what they, you know, worship Judaism
the way that they see fit.
All right.
I mean, I'm sure. That
but the officer wasn't having any of it. Read the last two lines, last paragraph. I apologize, I didn't underline it.
When my kids start expressing frustration with Israel as a society because what they hear and see from a distance is not welcoming to them in their religious practice, that's not good for the Jewish people, let alone for the state of Israel, says Rabbi Stephen Wernick, the director.
Right, so he's saying, like, this is actual alienation for Jews abroad when you try coming to the country and you're basically told you can't do Judaism as you have been brought up with. Take the first line of the next paragraph.
Secular Israelis do not see this as a problem. To them, it's a bunch of crazy American ladies. It's embarrassing for Israel, it's embarrassing for Jews, and the American Jewish community is beginning to understand that it's a slippery slope here.
Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of a division in that it's a bigger issue for the Americans because the Israelis don't really care. In Israel, not as prominent here. I mean, there are reforming conservative enclaves, but it's really not a big deal in the sense where you're either Orthodox, you know, or fully observant, or you're Chiloni and incredibly secular.
Right.
And if you're secular, you have almost nothing to do with it. If you're a non-Jew living in New York, there's a greater chance you know more about Judaism than a secular Israeli. It's really sad. However, you know, it does show a bit of the divide that it's really not their issue. Take the next paragraph.
The next chapter of what it means to be a Jewish state is being defined right now, says Alana Stokeman, the director of the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, who is writing a book that includes a chapter about women of the wall. We have to figure out, what does Israel want? What role do we really want religion to have in this state? And it's happening on the backs of women.
So I threw in the we part because, I mean, the truth is I don't know, you know, where Alana lives, but the fact that she's using this term we, right, who is the we that she's talking about? Is it women? Is it Jews? Is it Americans versus Israelis? Mm-hmm. Right? Is it feminists versus non-feminists? It's a very ambiguous pronoun in this case because who are the we will help determine, like, who is the right of that we to make any sort of argument or have any sort of impact on the state of Israel. Right? Now, if she's writing for Israelis to convince the Israeli population, here's what we should do, that's one thing. If she's trying to convince the American public of here's what you should advocate for Israel, well, that's already, you know, that's a big, you know, messy issue that people even talk about regarding politics, of to what extent should Americans or those who don't live in Israel dictate Israeli policy when they are not the ones directly affected by it. All right, and take the last couple of lines, underline lines.
In the last paragraph?
Well, first, Israel's Supreme Court ruled in 2003 that women cannot bring or pray garments at the Western Wall. Here was what they said. Doing so disrupts the public order. And we'll get back to that.
Right.
And finally, they're working, you know, there's right now a commission that's working on it. They say that the ultra-Orthodox majority does not represent the Jewish public. Which is a fascinating statement to say about how a majority doesn't represent the public, but the truth is,
but they're probably
it's not that diverse.
Like at the hotel.
Well, right. So, but that's going to be an important thing that we're going to see in a bit as well. So any thoughts so far?
I think it strikes a chord with a lot of people that either immigrate there or live there.
Mm-hmm.
People try to bring their own culture and their own society to Israel, and they mm-hmm. expect Israelis to comply with that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, I think what's kind of difficult, or the way that I would see it being difficult, if, you know, I was a member of this movement and everything along those lines, is just that, you know, Israel was kind of set up after the Holocaust, and it was like a safe haven for Jews to go, and mm-hmm. it's almost like now it's like Jews not like, you know, endangering lives, but Jews against other Jews and the way they want to practice.
Yeah, that was there from the beginning. Yeah, that was, I mean, maybe not as bad as it was today, mm-hmm. you know, but it's, yeah, that's not new.
Well, I'm not saying it's specific to this, but that would be, I don't know, to me that's a feeling of why this is so difficult.
Sure. So let's look at some of the halachic considerations here. I don't want to get into all of the details in terms of women praying in public, because I think that serves as a bit of a distraction, but there's just one, you know, piece that I do want to bring up, and that is about women wearing the tallit, in terms of, is that really prohibited? There are obviously people who say no. There are some people who give qualified endorsements. I believe Rav Moshe Feinstein said yes, as long as it's identifiable that it's a woman's tallit instead of a man's tallit, make some sort of distinction behind it. And he also, you know, questions motives. In my opinion, based on the Gemara we're about to read, I don't believe that that's correct, and we'll see why. Lisa, can you take source number 4? This is a Gemara Menachot 43b. Yeah.
Our rabbis taught all of us to observe the law of tzitzit, priests, Levites, and Israelites, proselytes, women, and slaves. Shimon declares women exempt since it is a positive precept dependent on a fixed time.
All right, so we can actually just stop here because it goes to... Well, now I finish the whole thing.
All right, and women are exempt from all positive precepts that are dependent on a fixed time. Rav Shimon declares women exempt. What is Rav Shimon's reason? It was taught that you may look upon it, the six...
Meaning when it says "ori temoto," that's the verse. You look upon it. What does that mean?
So this excludes a night garment. So if you say it excludes a night garment, but perhaps it is not so, but it excludes rather a blind man's garment. The verse when it says "wherewith thou coverest thyself" clearly includes a blind man's garment. How then must I explain the verse that you may look upon it as excluding a night garment? Now, why do you choose to include a blind man's garment and to exclude a night garment? Include a blind man's garment since it is looked upon by others, while I exclude a night garment since it cannot be looked upon by others.
Right. So the real operative thing comes all the way up at the beginning in plain English here. There's a dispute. According to Rav Shimon, which is actually, you know, how we practice today, women do not wear tzitzit because it is a time-bound commandment. That's fine. So what does it mean to have a time-bound commandment? It's because since tzitzit are not worn at night, they're only worn in the day, it is thus time-bound. And because it's time-bound, women are exempt. But that's only one opinion. The other opinion, that of the rabbis first stated, is that women have an obligation to wear tzitzit. Now, keep in mind that what does it mean to wear a tzitzit doesn't necessarily mean to wear a tallit. The obligation of wearing tzitzit is, if you happen to wear a four-cornered garment, it must have tzitzit on it. If you go to Nachlaot, you'll see people wearing these Mexican-type ponchos that are four-cornered, and they'll rightly put tzitzit on the outside. It's not that you specifically have to wear this garment that we happen to call a tallit. But what does this mean? You have a dispute where one opinion says women are obligated, another says women are exempt. There's absolutely no basis to say women are prohibited. Mm-hmm. At best, here's something to think about. If you want to say that, well, because our tallit has become culturally determined to be a man's garment, then you're basically saying that the prohibition about wearing garments that belong to opposite genders is therefore culturally dependent, which means if culture has changed to prohibit a tallit, then culture must have changed equally to say that women wearing pants is unequivocally permitted. Because clearly, by today's standards, women's pants are considered women's pants. It's considered women's clothes. No longer, well, men wear pants, women wear skirts. You walk around New York a block, women are wearing pants. You hope. They wear a lot less. Well, look, we're close to the village. You see some weird stuff there. So according to Pshat Gemara, there doesn't seem to be a prohibition for women wearing a tallit. Now, you may argue that it's prohibited for women to say blessing over the tallit, but the truth is, if you're following Ashkenazi practice, such that women bench lulav and etrog and take it upon themselves to say a time-bound positive, blessing over a time-bound positive commandment, then logically shouldn't be a problem here either. I would say that a bracha should be said on neither. Had a very amusing argument with Rav Temler about this, where he slapped me upside the head afterwards. because he was not a fan of, you know, he was complaining once about women at the Kotel who were shaking lulav and etrog, like in public. And I said, why? If you want to say that it's a bracha levatela, like that the women are saying an incorrect blessing, I'd agree. It's just like the blessing that your wife says when she shakes lulav and etrog too. He was not happy with that at all. Yeah, yeah. Well, we argued well in, back in the day. Anyway, but the point is, you've got a similar analogy there. That's more of that it's not done. But to say that there's in any way an intrinsic obligation, an intrinsic prohibition against women wearing a tallit seems to be subverted explicitly, very plainly by the Talmud, where no one, not only does no one say it's prohibited, but you've got an opinion that says it's obligatory. Now, it doesn't mean that we follow that opinion, although someone mentioned in Rav Tendler's class, too, that his brother-in-law was so super firm, he used to wear tzitzit at night. At which point, Rav Tendler said, oh, well, if he's so strict on that, then he should make his wife wear tzitzit, too. Because if you're going to be strict and follow the rabbis, then the woman has to do it as well. So he knew what was going on as well. So that's one category. But even if you assume that what they're doing is permitted or prohibited, you know, let's operate an assumption that it is permitted, right? We can talk about, let's say it is halakhically prohibited, like towards the end, we'll get there. But if it's permitted, who actually gets to set the halakhic policy for the kotel, right? Because as you say, like we do some things here that they wouldn't do there. Right? Who gets to determine what is halachic and what isn't halachic? It's great that I brought up a Gemara here, right? But people will say we don't follow that Gemara. And other people don't like it for any number of reasons. So just as a matter of authority, what are the rules about governing this location? Do you take the next source, number 5? This is written by Rabbi Professor David Galinkin. Link is online, affiliated with Conservative Judaism. It's a very, very interesting article in the history of the Kotel. So take it away.
Why is the Ministry of Religion in charge of the Kotel?
I should also say that this is only one section. It's a much larger article. But this is a section on why is the Ministry of Religion in charge of the Kotel? Here's a very fun historical survey.
In his recent book about Jewish holy places in Eretz Israel from 1948 to 68, Dr. Doron Bar, a senior lecturer in Land of Israel Studies at the Schechter Institute, devoted a chapter to the Kotel after the Six-Day War. In June of 1967, the Kotel was under the jurisdiction of Rabbi Goren of the IDF chaplains. A day after the war, bulldozers came and cleared away many houses near the Kotel to form a large plaza. At that time, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol and Defense Minister Moshe Dayan wanted to give the responsibility for all the religious and historical sites in Judea and Samaria, including the Kotel, to the National Parks Authority. Dr. Zera Warhaftig, the Minister of Religion, was adamantly opposed, and by June 26th of that year, the Kotel was under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Religion. At the same time, the Knesset passed the Protections of Holy Places Law 5727, also 1967, which appointed the chief rabbis of Israel to set the rules and regulations of the Kotel.
All right, so we've got the Knesset, democratically elected body of Israel, 1967, give the chief rabbis the authority over the Kotel. Here's some interesting tidbits to add.
Rabbi Shlomo Goren, the chief rabbi of the IDF, officially handed over the Kotel to Zera
Warhaftig
in July 3rd of 1967. Until that date, there was no mechitza at the newly cleared Kotel Plaza. By July 19th, the Ministry of Religion had erected a mechitza, and the men's section was 4 times larger than the women's. This led to a public outcry, and the Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol, called the area where the mechitza Mechilaot, or pens or prisons.
Mm-hmm.
Orthodox Jews in the Ministry of Religion reacted strongly and rejected the claims of those who said the Kotel should be given to the National Parks Authority. Others said the Kotel is only retaining a wall of the temple and therefore a secular historical remnant. The Ministry of Religion later set up Mishmar HaKotel, the Kotel Guard, in April of 68, whose members wore special uniforms.
Right, so you can stop there for a second, but isn't that fascinating? And in earlier paragraphs, it actually describes that there was no even a mechitza at the Kotel. The very fact of putting up the separation between men and women did, in fact, you know, cause a bit of a controversy, especially regarding the size. But at any rate, at the end of the day, it's the Ministry of Religion that has the right and authority to make the decisions over what goes on at the Kotel. So once they're given this power, again, by the democratically elected government, what is the rule about keeping customs? So the first source on this is Mishnah Pesachim 4:1, very beginning, says, where does the custom to do work on the eve of Passover until midday, one may do work? Where does the custom not to do work, one may not do work? He who goes from place to place where they work to a he who goes from a place where they work to a place where they do not work, or from a place where they do not work to a place where they do work, we lay upon him the restrictions of the place where he departed, and the restrictions of the place whither he has gone. And a man must not act differently from the local custom on account of the quarrels which would ensue. So the general rule is, and we have a separate class that we did on custom, as long as they're not, the custom is not telling you to violate Jewish law, then you have to do what the custom is, such that, you know, you don't actually start fights with the people around you. Gemara in Pesachim 50b says, the inhabitants of Chozai were accustomed to separate challah on rice. When they went and told it to Reb Joseph, he said to them, let a lay Israelite eat it in their presence. Abai raised an objection against him. There are things which are permitted, yet others treat as forbidden. You may not permit it in their presence. Right? So here, it's a matter of custom. Right? If something that's considered as prohibited, well then, you're not allowed to violate it in public. Although I should say that the Tosafot on here make a distinction, saying that if people say that it is prohibited, but it's not, then you are in fact allowed to do so in front of them, because they're just plain wrong. Meaning, there's a very important difference, legal difference, even though it might seem trivial semantically, a very big legal difference saying something is halakhically asur, it is forbidden, versus it can't be done here. Meaning saying it's a matter of minhag, right? Very important distinction there. So let's say they say, well, this is the practice appropriate for the Kotel, and they don't use that term asur, then it would seem, by having the women of the wall come in and have public Torah readings where talit, they would in fact be violating the rules regarding minhag ha-makom. And again, who has the right to set up the minhag ha-makom? In this case, it happens to be the religious ministry. How did they get that authority? Because the Knesset gave it to them. In theory, you know, the Knesset could just as easily take it away, right? I can't imagine that happening, but that's how the system kind of works. And say, well, who gives the Knesset the right to make that decision? Well, that's kind of how democracy works, all right? So that's one issue. The other, and we're going to go back and forth in terms of pros and cons of it. The next issue, you know, that's worthwhile bringing up are a couple of pieces on religious coercion. Actually gave a full source on, shear on this. I think Current Jewish Questions number 1 or 2 devoted to religious coercion, but a couple of sources here that I think are relevant. Because, you know, whether or not they're doing things that are legal or illegal, you know, what is the appropriate response religiously? Right? Is it appropriate to, say, spit on people or things like that? So, 2 important Gemaras here.
Okay.
Yeah, Josh?
So, Brachot 19b.
Brachot 19b.
Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, if one finds mixed kinds in his garment,
in shatnez,
he takes it off even in the street.
A linen and wool mixed together.
What is the reason? It says, there is no wisdom nor understanding nor counsel against the Lord. Wherever a profanation of God's name is involved, no respect is paid to a teacher.
Mm-hmm. But do the Gemara in Brachot 20a.
There was the case of Rab Ada ben Abba, who saw a heathen woman wearing a redhead dress in the street.
A redhead dress. A redhead dress in the street. There you go.
And thinking that she was an Israelite woman, he rose and tore it from her. It turned out that she was a heathen woman, and they fined him 400 zuz.
People have a quizzical look here. Seems weird, doesn't it? So you have a case here where a guy saw a woman wearing something inappropriate. Based on your commentators, it could either be it was too ostentatious or it was, in fact, had shatnez, a mixture of linen and wool, which the Torah prohibits wearing. And he ripped it off her, or tore off her. Right? That seems to be a form of religious coercion. No? Of like, you're breaking Jewish law, I have a right to go out and intervene. But there's a catch in that you actually have to be right.
Huh.
Right? Because in this case, if the woman wasn't Jewish, which means whatever prohibition that might have involved in wearing this thing on her head didn't apply. Because it didn't apply, he acted inappropriately and therefore fined her money. Right? Fined him money for, you know, public embarrassment. Now that's a pretty important thing there when you talk about religious coercion. Right? You have to be, if you're going to start impacting someone else's rights and treating them like really, really poorly, right? Now, I would argue spinning is probably not the best. I mean, I could throw in more stuff here about tochacha. How do you give rebuke? I would say that getting spat upon, or I should say spitting on someone, is not going to be convincing of like, hey, I'm going to change my practices. Just as, you know, the women who wear furs and periodically got paint thrown on them, I don't think really discouraged them for, you know, wearing fur in the future. So yeah, in terms of tochacha, spitting on people, probably not that effective. I can also say right now, I have not done a test study on what works versus what doesn't.
But like throwing rocks.
Exactly. Meaning, is that really going to stop people from violating things? No.
So you
probably violate a lot more that way. But a step further of, if you're in fact going to impede on other people that they're doing something that wrong, you damn well be sure you're right. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case here, right, let's say it's like, I'm going to spit on this woman because she's wearing a tallit. Well, you know, we just saw a couple of sources ago that that's not how, you can think it's halakhically, you know, wrong. But, you know, if the worst thing you can say is, well, you're violating minhag ha-makom and therefore I can spit on you, well, that's a pretty big jump between violating biblical law and, you know, not doing what everyone else is doing, because there are a whole bunch of minhagim out there.
But you can, if you're right, you can do something. It's just...
Well, there are two different issues here. One is there are two issues. One is a matter of tochacha, like how do you actively rebuke someone? And the other is how do you prevent a person from sinning? But assuming, again, that they are, in fact, actually sinning. Mm-hmm. So one is a matter of, I need to stop you in the moment because you're doing something wrong, mm-hmm. versus, hey, I need to educate someone to prevent them from, like, you know, continuing. All right? And the question is what you're trying to do.
Don't they not pray at the wall anymore, though? Because the ladies that invited me for Rosh Chodesh, like, they were doing it at some other part of the wall.
They still do, and they still get arrested from time to time. Lisa, could you take the next source here? And this is the whole source is really for like the last line that I've quoted here that's really important for our discussion.
Alrighty. Hoffman again dismissed the solution proposed by the Supreme Court in 2003 to establish a prayer area for non-Orthodox denominations in the Robinson's Arch complex, likening it to sitting at the back of the bus.
Oh, yeah.
If it's so holy, if it's such a hot spot, why don't the ultra-Orthodox go there, she asked. I want to choose wherever I want to sit on the bus, and I don't need government permission to pray next to the wall. The Robinson's Arch area does not have the same amenities and 24-hour accessibility as the Western Wall Plaza, but Hoffman said that even if the site was upgraded, it would not be acceptable unless it were accessible from the plaza. I want to see and be seen.
I want to see and be seen. Very unfortunate choice of words here. Right. So again, she is mentioning as an interesting argument where if it's so holy, why don't other people want to go there? There's a sense of There's a sense of what we're doing is inferior. Exactly. It's an inferior place. But then she has this line, I want to see and be seen.
So it's like a political thing.
Yes. But there are a couple of problems with this halachically. Take source number 11. This is a Gemara in Bracha 24b.
One who says the tefillah so that it can be heard is a small faith. Rabbi Huna said it was meant to apply only if he is able to concentrate his attention when speaking in a whisper. But if he cannot concentrate his attention when speaking in a whisper, it is allowed. And this is the case only when he is praying alone. But if he is with the congregation, he must not do so because he may disturb the congregation.
It's amazing halacha here that we don't... I mean, unfortunately, there are many places that don't follow it. But although that would be culturally relative, too. Like, there's some yeshiva where everyone, like, davens really loudly. But let's say you're not, then you are not allowed to daven your private Shemona Esrei loudly because you're going to disturb other people. There's a concern where if you're... I mean, there's a concern for basic leaders. This is more than just minhag ha-makom. This is when people pray, don't annoy other people. Now, here you have a group, which, right or wrong, by virtue of the presence, remember what was said earlier, it would be disruptive, are in fact being disruptive. And you can argue that the intent is to be disruptive. But you're trying to be disruptive in the context of prayer, which is halakhically wrong. You're not supposed to do that. Now, you can argue, well, it's not fair that, you know, they're doing this and they're not being disruptive, but we're disrupted when we do this. And the answer is yes. Right? People, you know, what makes something disruptive or not? When it says, Ate Lemitra Tzibura, right? Whatever whatever is going to be more of an annoyance to the congregation is entirely relative to where you happen to be. And for better or for worse, that the clientele that show up at the Kotel, women doing this sort of thing, and especially doing it out loud, to use the term of the Women of the Wall from the mission statement, is a lot more disruptive than having 15 minyanim going around you. I would also say, technically, you shouldn't, like, that would also apply to the beggars who, like, go up to people as you're in the middle of davening asking for money. Also should not be done, right? And you could argue, y'all, in theory, they too should get thrown out, but that in no way validates, you know, what the Women of the Wall are doing. Right?
Sometimes they do.
Well, okay. Well, it would be appropriate if they did. But yes, the point is, using prayer as a public demonstration to make a point, as Ms. Hoffman, said, violates, in my opinion, the Gemara Bracha 24b about not calling attention to yourself in davening, because that's not what prayer is about. Prayer is not a political statement. Prayer is talking to God. More importantly, this is a great source that we did in the class on Tzniut, which recommend everyone listen to. Yeah. The only time I shouldn't say the only time, there's a pasuk in Micha of Hatznei Alecha Imelkecha that you're supposed to walk humbly or modestly before your God. The Gemara in Sukkah 49b says, in the school of Rav Anan, it was taught, it is written, the roundings of thy thighs. Why are the words of the Torah compared to the thigh? To teach you, just as the thigh is hidden, so too the words of the Torah should be hidden. Meaning it should be taught in privacy, not in the marketplace. And this is the import of what Rav Elazar says. What is the implication of the text? It has been told thee, O man, what is good, and do what the Lord require of you. Only do justly, justly love mercy, walk humbly with God. To do justly means act in accordance with justice. To love mercy refers to acts of loving kindness, and to walk humbly before God refers to intending to funerals and dowering a bride before her wedding. Money quote, and can we not make a deduction a fortiori, mean kal vachomer, if matters which are normally performed publicly by the Torah, now can we not make a deduction if in manners which are normally performed publicly, the Torah enjoins to walk humbly, how much more so in matters that are done privately? And in the context of the Tzniut class, I pointed out the irony that once you have a public demonstration complaining about women's lack of Tzniut, you are in fact violating the Talmudic ethic of Tzniut, because you're not supposed to have public... I mean, there are certain things about, doing mitzvot in public, like, say, reading Megillah, right? Berovam Hadrat Melech, with a great multitude of nations you can praise the Lord, right? But you're...
It's like the demonstration part.
The demonstration part seems to be the problem. If you're supposed to act humbly with tziniut, or modestly, however you want to define that in English, with public events such as funerals and weddings, well, that should also apply to prayer. Now, again, you can argue, well, this seems to be a bit of a double standard, because men seem to do a whole lot of things publicly, and it's okay. But the difference is this. The difference is, and here's where you have the questions of motivation. Whereas the Women of the Wall, clearly have, based on their own mission statement, say, well, we want to change the entire paradigm. It's no longer a matter of, well, we just want to pray to God and do things our way, because the truth is they had an option, which is to go to Robinson's Arch, right? So it's, we want the right to do things where we are in the middle, in the center of everything, specifically to prove our point. And that is a very, very different type of argument. All right? Now let's go back to some of the questions that we kind of glossed over here. So we were saying that the problem is worshiping where we want, when we want it. Question. Does Israel have 100% complete religious tolerance and freedom? No. You laugh. You say no. How not?
Because,
aside from this, this is one example. But a few other examples not like this. Where does the Kotel, how does the religious authority, specifically around the Old City, restrict Jewish worship? I can give you a couple of examples. One, Jews are not allowed to pray in Har HaBayit. You can't go up to the Temple Mount and pray. Right? So that is a case where the government says, we are going to restrict how you worship and where you worship. And you can't say it's a matter of religious freedom. Or look at a few other things by the Kotel, right? Would it be okay if, say, a group of Christians were to come down and perform a ritual, Christian ritual, erect a huge cross in front of the Kotel? You'd say probably not. That, too, is an infringing on your religious freedoms. Or the Kotel itself. The very fact that there is a mechitza, right, the very fact there is a separation between men and women, infringes on the religious rights of people who insist on praying in an egalitarian minion. Right? So the fact is, it is not unprecedented for, you know, Israel to restrict the worship of Judaism, or at least restrict it to say there are certain things that you can do in certain areas but not others. If I were to, say, go to the Kotel and slaughter a goat around Pesach time, I would start a riot. If I do it in my, you know, if I did it in my sister's backyard, she'd be really, really annoyed with me. Although my brother would probably like, you know, the fresh meat, but, you know, they would not be happy, right? But the government wouldn't care if you try to do Korban Pesach that way. So in terms of, like, the restrictions, the rights are not absolute. And to say that, well, we want to do things on our terms, yes, you can couch it in these other, you know, global statements, but once you have these unrestricted global statements, you're going to run into a whole lot of other problems. All right? Now, can you take the last source here? This is an important, the other point in terms of who gets to decide what. This is a quote, I should say, from Jonathan Tobin from Commentary Magazine. I will throw in a plug. If anyone is interested in being, like, well-read, politically stuff, Commentary is a Jewish, politically conservative magazine, and Jonathan Tobin, in my opinion, is one of the best writers for religiously Jewish, politically conservative writing. You may disagree with some, if not everything, that he says, but if you're interested in getting a balance and want an intelligent conservative to read, read him. Yeah.
Okay. The battle over the women of the wall is just one more illustration of the gap between the rhetoric about Israel being the heritage of all of the Jewish people and the fact that the country is, as a matter of course, always going to be governed to suit the needs and the beliefs of those who live there.
Very concisely nails it, right? The problem is this. For generations, Israel has touted itself as, you know, we're the homeland for all the Jewish people. They will do a great deal of, you know, recruitment, but certainly in America, let's just focus on America for right now. Israel is a core part of Jewish identity, and people are still working to make Israel a core part of Jewish identity. On Jewish population surveys, Israel's featured very prominently there. Big fight about, do you support Israel, do you not support Israel? And Israel has relied on American support, Jewish support, not just Orthodox, politically, in terms of influencing politicians, financially, supporting bonds, vacations, all that sort of thing, right? But now there's a bit of a disconnect, which is, Israel says that they want me, like they want me, and this is part of my country, except when I get there, I'm brushed aside. My type of Judaism, my religion doesn't matter. And this is causing one of many problems of who gets the right to determine what goes on in Israel, right? So if I'm an American, like let's say I'm a conservative Jew or a Reform Jew, and I say, well, if this is the way Israel is treating me, well, then why should I care about Israel? Right? They clearly don't want me. And by the same token, by what right do I have to impose, you know, here's the way that I want the Kotel to be run, even though I'm not a citizen there. Right? Should the citizens have more of a right to determine what goes on there? Or should other people do so? And in which case, you know, which Israel are they going to follow? Is it, yes, we want you to support Israel, but of course Israel's only going to be on our terms. And then once you have outsiders dictating what Israel should do, then you get a nice little question about what does it mean to be part of a democracy? Is it financially supporting, or does it mean living and being part of the culture and everything else and paying for votes? And it's that march is a very tricky issue. I'm curious to hear your other opinions. My own just happens to be citizens determine what goes on there. And if it's really that big of a deal, then start affecting the Knesset. And a story was that I just read today regarding more conversion issues with the Rabbanut. And, you know, people are like, oh, we have to put pressure on the Rabbanut. And I was like, I don't know how that works, right? Because the Rabbanut is what it is. And if you don't like it, you have to move to Israel and work to take it down inside from the democracy. Now, that may or may not actually happen, but, you know, as an outsider, like, what can you think? They can safely ignore all American rabbis and no one's going to really care. Because what are American rabbis going to do? Start saying, yes, don't give money to Israel until they, you know, get kicked out? It'll be curious if anyone does actually articulate that, but if they do, it would be incredibly controversial, and odds are shut down completely. I should say that with this, I had an argument with my father about the whole Women of the Wall and the authority. My father has a very low opinion of the Rabbanut, threw out a whole bunch of insults that I don't feel comfortable repeating either here or on, you know, recording. But his argument is that they don't have halakhic authority. And this was sort of a disagreement I have, is that, well, at the end of the day, they were appointed by the democratically elected, you know, group. Like it or not, they set the legal and civil policies, right? So there's that. In terms of, you know, the getting spat upon, that's probably, you know, a bit much, you know, from anyone. But in terms of, are they breaking civil law? Yes. And the public demonstrations about getting arrested are to call attention to breaking civil law. That's what civil disobedience is. Right, where something's going, where, like when Rosa Parks, you know, sat in the front of the bus, she was breaking the law. Well, she, yes, they do, and she's sitting at the back of the bus. But, you know, they're calling attention to a law which they say is discriminatory, stupid, evil, whatever you want to do it. The question is, how much sympathy can you raise for other people to agree with it? What I can say, though, is that regardless of whether or not you think of it civilly is correct, I can say both sides are wrong here. That the side of the Rabbanut saying what they're doing is intrinsically asur, I think is unjustifiable. By the same token, saying, well, we have a right to do it using, you know, civil language, doesn't jive halakhically. Because halakhically, you don't have a right to go into a place and start dictating things. An analogy I gave to friends of mine who are supportive was, well, you're a rabbi in Orthodox synagogue, let's say women come in and sit on the men's section because they want to. What are you going to do? It's like, oh. Good point.
Right.
And that's kind of what's going on here. Because you've got women, you know, women are coming in acting differently than the way it's established. Do you have a right to do that? No. And I don't think the women, I mean, the fact that the women haven't tried that, like they acknowledge some authority of the religious authority and said, like, yes, there's a separate section for men and women, but we're going to want to do what we want on the, you know, on the women's side. Which is a nice, you know, logical case, but who says the Rabbanut is logical? Right? They already say no. So there you go. And if you want to say that, well, you know, they're not imposing on our on anyone else's beliefs, well, maybe, maybe not. There was another great article on commentary that described, well, what about all the women who are on the women's section? Forget about the men for a second. What about the women on the women's section who don't want to be around that? Meaning it is offensive to them, meaning let's say the more traditional or the more Haredi women who are praying on the women's side who don't want to be around women wearing talitot or women reading in public. Right? And then you've got the thing of like, well, whose rights take precedence over someone else's? And in this case, yes, you have a governing authority that makes that determination of whose rights proceed, you know, takes precedence over someone else's. But that's an important point to consider, that the just as the Haredi community might not speak for all Jews, Women of the Wall don't speak for all women.
Exactly.
Neither does Jofa, right? No one speaks for all of anyone. And that is an intrinsic problem when you speak in these grandiose universalistic claims that you're really looking out for everyone because your rights are going to infringe on someone else's. Any thoughts? Questions on any of this? I hope we got to any all the questions that were raised earlier.
Yeah, I'm still unclear as to whether or not they're conservative or not. Just because when I was there, I remember them, like, distinctly remember them going to that Robinson's Arch instead of the Kotel. I mean, I don't think anyone was getting arrested that day.
No one would do it there because there it's illegal. The only place where it's illegal is at the Kotel itself.
Right. So
they wouldn't be arrested if they went to Robinson's Arch.
No, right, but I'm saying I don't remember that anyone getting arrested.
So oh, yeah, yeah.
Went
this,
to the Kotel,
like, December.
I'm pretty sure that they were going to Robinson's Arch. But
well, every now and again, like a couple of, like, I think it was
like
in December. Yeah, in December they went to the, in December they went to the Kotel. There was a whole big thing, got arrested. Yeah. It's, you know, one of the things.
They
again,
do
you
it
did,
as a statement, you're saying.
Yes.
Not
to get,
doing it
to, well, no,
doing
no.
It for publicity.
Yes, but I also believe they believe what they're doing is correct.
Right,
meaning it's not, well, you say of course, but it's not a random you know, publicity stunt. It is a publicity stunt, but there's more to it than just that. Like,
right.
They believe on their principles. We ought to have a right to do that.
But at the same time, like, they have, like, integrity of, like, we still want to do this. So, like, wherever we're going to go, like, we're still going to...
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, we'll use whatever space they
So you brought up, like, the conservative, you know, thing again. Now, again, I can argue, I'm not sure what difference it would make whether or not they would call themselves conservative or orthodox. Because, to be blunt, it's just semantic. Like, there's no trademark over conservative or orthodox or reform. I could call myself Reconstructionist. Well, people would yell at me anyway about, like, oh, you're calling yourself that, right?
Just in terms of tangible halacha, like, I think tangibly that it's not prohibited for a woman to wear a tallit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is prohibited for a woman to be counted in a minyan, is that correct?
It's hard to say if you actually, like, break in the Easter, or let's say, let's just say yes. It'll be easier to just say yes.
Okay. Well, I remember learning.
Well, it's a big fight over that. Yeah. Well, it's also a big fight about whether it's permanent. Let's just say yes. Here. Right? But, again, when you say, like...
So wouldn't that be a tangible halacha? They're actually...
But the point... So this is a fascinating thing, because the point is, it's a step beyond orthodox, meaning... Orthodox is more of a culture than a social culture than it is a set of halachic principles. Because the truth is, and written about this, you know, and spoke about this at length in Shul here, there are certain things you do that the Orthodox community would say you are no longer Orthodox. And those things that might get you kicked out of Orthodoxy might not actually violate Jewish law. On the other hand, you could violate clear Jewish laws and people still say you're Orthodox. So the example, you know, that I give is, it's not uncommon to go to point at a conservative Jew and say, that person is an Orthodox because they're not keeping kosher, right? But no one will say that, oh, that person is an Orthodox. Like, no one will say, you know, you can still be considered Orthodox if you steal, if your yeshiva launders money, you beat your wife, molest kids. No one says child molesters are no longer Orthodox, whereas someone who eats tefillah is not a from Jew, right? So those distinctions don't necessarily matter.
Right.
But I can say this, like, if they have a right to set up the halachic policy, it's not a matter of Orthodox, non-Orthodox, or even it's... The only thing that you as an Orthodox, as in Shomer Torah,
right,
would not be allowed to follow, be completely justified in ignoring them, is if they told you to break Jewish law. Right? Which they're not doing here. Right? Because there's no obligation for women to wear tallit.
Right.
There's no obligation for women to, you know, have a Torah reading.
Right.
So by preventing that, they're not preventing the women from doing Jewish law.
Right.
They're preventing women from doing, you know, practicing Judaism as they see it. But if they didn't, right, Jewish law's not violated.
No one's violated.
Right? But if they, you know, right. So that would...
I guess they think about it as, like, halachic versus non-halachic. Forget,
yes,
Orthodox or conservative.
You are correct, but then the question is, how do you determine what,
like,
is?
Right,
so I've got my own system that I learned from my father, and he learned from his teacher about how halacha is decided, and the rabbanut has their system,
right,
about what is halachic and what is not halachic. As long as they're in charge and not me, they're going to set the policy. If anyone wants that to change, yeah, you know, we got some time before that ever happens.
And then you have people that are like, well, my rabbi says, and
exactly,
that's who I go by.
Exactly, and that's exactly the problem and where everything breaks down,
right?
Right? So what I could argue is then, if I'm really upset with the rabbanut, the real answer is go to Israel, get a 2-zahut, start voting in the elections,
right,
be active in the political process, and change it from the inside such that the rabbanut does not have that amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
I wish more of the modern type people would do that. I don't think they want the fight. I'm not sure if they would win, because let's not forget, secular Israelis don't care. And for the ones who are religious, I think there are going to be more Haredi on the right-wing side, regardless, between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, than they are of the more modern side.
Mm-hmm.
So in which case, you're a minority within a half, right? So if, you know, they could get all the secular Israelis on their side, fine. But the secular Israelis, you know, like they said here, just they think it's a bunch of crazy American women. Like,
I think they tend, I mean... Maybe, I don't know how many of the Israeli population I've met, but I've met quite a few Chilumis,
yeah,
that when presented with issues like this tend to side more on the traditional or the conservative, because their family back in wherever they came from had some tradition. Like, they, I mean, maybe I'm referring to like more Masoreti people, but like Masoreti, I'm not talking about religion.
Right.
This
so
is not Dati.
Masoreti does exist there, but I wouldn't necessarily consider them secular.
But I don't even mean like the movement of Masoreti. I just mean like
the quasi-traditional. Right. But
very quasi.
Consider that your typical secular Israeli has no connection with the Rabbanut. Like, isn't really going to care. Right,
that's
so it's like you know, because you know what's the point of? I mean, the rabbis only bother you when they determine religious policy, and you actually
and
care about the religion because you don't care about the religion. It's like, yeah, whatever religious policy, do what you want at the Kotel. It's not like I'm ever going to go. Big deal. Josh, any thoughts?
No, I mean, pretty much everything that was. I understand everything that you're saying. I think it's a little bit of a tricky.
Mm.
A little bit of a touchy subject, I think.
Yeah.
I understand what both sides. I don't know. I think I need to formulate my own opinion.
Lisa, any thoughts?
Do I have any thoughts?
I think it's difficult, though.
Yeah.
Difficult to get involved in a society and change the culture from within without publicizing your viewpoint. And I think I think it's legitimate, although they're clearly disturbing the peace and making other people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to get any ad time on television.
Sure.
I think this is one way to try to do that.
Oh, I mean, is it effective? Sure. You know, is it enough to muster support within Israel to change the system? I don't know. I mean, there are people who are ticked off at the Rabbanut for a whole lot of reasons. This is one. Conversions is another. You know, maybe if they all band together to overthrow the Rabbanut, you might be able to get some traction and then change the whole thing. You know, I've heard people advocate to nudge towards a full separation of church and state, meaning the Rabbanut's issue is that they're getting involved in politics. Meaning if the Rabbanut just sticks to religious issues but has no real religious authority, no political authority, legal political authority by which they can impose their halachic decisions, you know, then it's like choose to, like if you're religious, you follow it, and if not, you don't.
Right.
And they'll bring on a whole bunch of other questions. But yeah, I understand why they do this. I understand why they do it at the Kotel, knowing that they're going to get arrested, because they believe in this strongly enough that, you know, it's worthwhile, that they think are going to change in the future. And they, you know, could in theory argue that those end results supersede any halakha that we did before. There's also another Shirei Aven Hora Atsha'a, you know, emergency ruling dispensation, like, you know, this is important enough, we need to break what's necessary. But the question is also, is your position really correct? Because again, you're going to fight for your rights, which effectively means taking away from others. Mm-hmm. And if it's just a matter of you want the freedom to worship, hey, the truth is you can worship as you wish, but your argument is we want to do what we want, as we want it, where we want it. And then you need to ask, does anyone have a right to make that statement? And where would the lines be drawn? Right? And what would be the difference between them doing that, someone else doing Korban Pesach, or someone going up to the Temple Mount, or a woman who wants to pray on the men's section, or people from other religions who want to go to the Kotel and worship their gods in any way that they see fit? Because, and it's not so much a slippery slope argument as much as logical conclusion. If your ultimate argument is, we can, you know, we have an inalienable, unassailable right to worship as we see fit, where we see fit, then why do you have this, but someone else doesn't?
We don't even have that in America.
That's true. Certain public ground. Well, I guess
right, America. Like public, like isn't there some?
Well, that's because of separation of church and state, and then it gets like a little bit messy there too. But yeah, I mean, there's no freedom which is absolute. Look, freedom of speech, for as much as we say, we get restricted with that. I mean, the campaign finance reforms, you know, is a restriction on free speech. Right, and I'm not talking about fire in a crowded building. He's like, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed. It's incitement. You know, you're not allowed to threaten to kill the president. You know, that sort of thing. You know, free speech. Like, no. You know, there are things that you're still not allowed to do. You know, again, strict halacha is what they want to do against halacha. I don't think so. Taking it to a broader standpoint, I think, gets you into very big problems politically. Doing the stuff that they're doing now, I think, gets you into contemporary problems halachically, in terms of breaking the minhag ha-makom, and in terms of using the religion to score political points in terms of making a public demonstration. And at the end of the day, you know, an open question of to what extent the relationship should be between Israel and the diaspora, in terms of the diaspora dictating or having any sort of influence influence on what Israel should do. Again, this applies not just religiously and politically, particularly when it doesn't affect you. There are certain areas when it does. You can argue that politically, you know, they're not going to be as affected as much by, say, the peace process as much as what is it like to go to the Kotel, right? Which is something that many people from America do, in which case, well, if you want us to come, you know, how are you going to treat us when we're there? And also for, you know, American rabbis in terms of other converts being accepted. But that's a much, much longer conversation that's we're not going to even touch now. Anyway, thank you very much for coming out. Have a wonderful night.